Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. Well, the lead story today is being splashed on headlines around the world, and that concerns the discovery of alien life. That's right, NASA has found alien life, not in outer space, not in the United States Congress, but in California, in the form of tiny microbes with DNA that has never been seen before, forcing a major revision of every single biology textbook on the planet Earth. So we'll discuss this new discovery and the implications in exploration. And then we're going to go into outer space to talk about a secret spy plane. Did you know that the United States Air Force has been testing a secret spy plane called the X-37B? It just landed at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California after 7 months in outer space, and people are still scratching their heads wondering, what is it used for? Why are we building this X-37B space plane, which looks like a leftover from the Cold War? And then on the medical front, we're going to be talking about cyborg legs. Is it possible that one day we may be able to create exoskeletons, just like in the Hollywood movies, which will allow people who are paralyzed the ability to walk once again? Well, now we have not just one, but several commercial organizations that are fielding pants, arms, mechanical legs that will allow the paralyzed to walk once again. With motion sensors, mechanical braces, people can stand up and even take their first steps toward freedom. And then we're going to bring on our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Professor Peter Ward, an astronomer, and he's the author of a rather controversial book called The Flooded Earth. That's right, he doesn't mince any words. He says it's coming, not tomorrow, not day after tomorrow, but in the coming decades, a flooded Earth. So what does that mean for our way of life? What does that mean for the world's great cities and populations? What does it mean if we have a flooded Earth? Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story today concerns the discovery of alien life in our own backyard in California. That's right. You take a trip to Yosemite National Park. Right outside there is Lake Mono. And Lake Mono has drainage from the Sierra Nevada mountains. As a consequence of the runoff, there are high concentrations of toxic chemicals inside that lake, including arsenic. Well, this is what some scientists did. They went to Lake Mono, dredged some of the murky soil from the bottom of the lake, separate out the microbes that exist in the lake, and then hit these microbes with an arsenic environment. Now, these microbes live in an arsenic environment, but by putting them in a very toxic environment, they were able to replace the phosphorus in the DNA of the bacteria with arsenic, which by rights should have killed the bacteria. It turns out that phosphorus and arsenic are very close to each other. Look at the periodic chart. They are in the same column of the periodic chart, one right on top of the other. They're very similar chemically. However, arsenic occurs in water-soluble compounds in unstable form. Therefore, arsenic, masquerading as phosphorus, can incorporate into a body's cells and then kill it because water-soluble arsenic compounds are unstable. Well, that's where this big breakthrough took place. Scientists realized that these microbes did not die. They thrived. They thrived in an arsenic environment which should have killed them. And then by analyzing the DNA, they realized that, yes, indeed, arsenic incorporated themselves into the DNA molecule, which was thought to be impossible, without causing the DNA molecule to fall apart. Well, that caused a shattering amount of interest, a firestorm, a media stampede as people began to wonder, what was NASA hiding? Was NASA hiding a flying saucer? Was NASA hiding an alien that they captured? No. The alien was not E.T. The alien was a germ. A germ found in Lake Mono that represents a new form of life. Now, if you are a science fiction buff, this story was a tremendous dud. I mean, no E.T., no flying saucer, no Roswell, just bugs. However, if you are a science buff, the result was sensational. NASA hit the ball right out of the ballpark on this one. It means that every single textbook on the planet Earth has to be rewritten. The very definition of life itself has to be changed. And think of DNA. Think of DNA as Lego blocks. You can attach Lego blocks in any way you want, and you get millions, billions of combinations. In the same way, if you rearrange the blocks of DNA, you can create any life form you want, from yeast cells to elephants, even to people. Well, here's where it gets interesting. Now replace some of these Lego blocks with alien Lego blocks that we've never seen before, that easily incorporate themselves into the normal DNA structure. And then you could begin to realize that we could be creating, in fact, an entirely new form of life in the laboratory. And this could be just the beginning. Look at the periodic chart. You realize that many chemicals mimic carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, and as a consequence, perhaps we can switch some of these molecules and DNA will remain stable. Or perhaps other forms that we haven't even thought of can exist that can reproduce themselves. So at the very least, what it means is we have to widen our scope when it comes to looking for extraterrestrial life on the moons of Saturn, Jupiter, on extrasolar planets. We have to throw away our prejudices. For example, back in 1976, when we put two landers on Mars, these landers were specifically designed to look for hydrocarbon chemistry. Well, perhaps aliens don't use hydrocarbon chemistry. So we have to widen our scope and drop our prejudices. Second of all, not only will all the textbooks have to be rewritten, but this may also have commercial and industrial applications. For example, a tremendous bulk of organic chemistry comes from understanding the chemistry of microbes. Think, for example, of energy production. Energy production comes from a single molecule called ATP. That's why we can move our arms and legs. That's where the energy of our muscles come from, a chemical called ATP, where P is phosphorus. Now think of what happens if you can replace that phosphorus with a different atom like arsenic. So we have to look at the question of fertilizer. Fertilizer, which of course are a multi-billion dollar industry, allowing us to feed hundreds of millions, billions of people, well, it turns out that fertilizers depend on nitrogen. Well, perhaps one day we'll be able to replace nitrogen with another atom. What then? So you can see the implications for organic chemistry. Organic chemistry is vitally involved in the production of plastics, polymers, oil, in the production of energy, fertilizer, and who knows, maybe some of these microbes may have a direct application there. However, once again, if you are a science buff and you dreamed about riding on a flying saucer, well, you may have to delay a bit because this will definitely not allow us to encounter intelligent life in outer space. And one more thing. We scientists believe that microbial life may be rather common throughout the galaxy. So far, we've discovered 500 large Jupiter-sized planets, but eventually we'll discover scores of Earth-like twins in outer space. But probably at best, many of them will have microbial life, because after all, microbes existed on the Earth for billions of years, and intelligent life, just like us, on the Earth is only 100,000 years old. Modern humans emerged from Africa about 100,000 years ago, and that compares to the 3.5 billion years that life has been on the Earth. So if life in outer space is anything like life on Earth, it means that microbial life may be rather common, but intelligent life could be quite rare. In other words, we might be the only game in town in this sector of the Milky Way galaxy. And speaking about outer space, people are scratching their heads wondering, what is the purpose of the X-37B spy plane? Well, this is a spy plane left over from the Cold War. It landed after 7 months in outer space in Vandenberg Air Force Base. And people are wondering, well, what is the purpose of shooting up a spy plane like the X-37B? Well, first of all, if you were to take a look at it, it looks like a snub-nosed version of the ordinary space shuttle. That's right, takes off like a rocket, lands like an airplane. It is 29 feet long, quite short, 14 feet across from wingtip to wingtip. It weighs only a little bit over 5 tons, which is small compared to the space shuttle. It can do a few tricks. For example, it can maneuver in outer space. It can change orbit. But what is its purpose? Well, some people think that maybe it's an orphan of the Cold War. Well, we really don't know for sure. Originally, it was built for NASA. Until the year 2004, when NASA was scratching its heads, wondering, what are we going to do with this spy plane? So they gave it to DARPA, a division of the Pentagon. They scratched their heads. They didn't know what to do with it, and they passed it on to the United States Air Force in 2006. So what is the purpose of this? Well, we're not quite sure. However, let me say this. Back in 1957, when Sputnik went up into orbit, well, even before then, the United States had a plan to explore outer space sequentially, step by step, putting science, not military expectations, at the forefront. The idea then was to build a space plane. That is, a plane that would take off like an ordinary jet, soar like a rocket, and then land like a jet again. The advantage of that is you would have immediate access to outer space. Within a matter of minutes, you could send pilots, suit them up, shoot them into outer space, and bring them back down. Well, instead of the space plane, what we got was a space turkey called the Space Shuttle. The Space Shuttle is an engineering marvel, but let's face it, it takes months to get it ready for operation, not just a few minutes, but months to years to plan a single mission. And the cost is about $800 million per mission, almost $1 billion per mission of the Space Shuttle. And what does it do? Well, we have 7 astronauts, but most of those astronauts' missions can be done by robots. In fact, the X-37B is totally robotic. There are no pilots on the X-37B at all, and it maneuvers quite fine in outer space. And in fact, the Soviets, at the height of the Cold War, built their copy of the space shuttle, which looks like a carbon copy of our own space shuttle. They called it the Buran, meaning storm in Russian. And it was fully automated, fully automated. Took off, landed without a single pilot on board. That's how far robotics have come, that we can actually shoot entire space shuttles into orbit and have them land without any humans whatsoever. So a space plane, we thought, was perhaps the way to go. Cheap, economical, but then the Cold War came. And during the Cold War, we needed to haul huge amounts of cargo into outer space. We needed the ability to perhaps intercept satellites. So in some sense, the space shuttle was a big success. In another sense, it was a flop. The space shuttle was a success because it worked. It sent our astronauts into outer space. But it was a flop in the sense that it was really never reusable. Costs were enormous. Delay times were huge. And right now, we're simply saying that we cannot afford a space shuttle. So where is the X-37B spy plane going to go? Well, we don't know for sure. It's an orphan. And let's say a few things about medicine. Artificial legs, cyborgs, the things you see in RoboCop, the movies that Hollywood produces, have been a dream for quite a while, but now they are beginning to become reality. Not one, but several commercial organizations are now debuting with their mechanical exoskeleton, which will allow the paralyzed the ability to walk once again. For example, think of the ReWalk. The ReWalk is a mechanical exoskeleton that you put on, sort of like pants, except the pants are braced with metal. There's a battery in the ReWalk that lasts for 3.5 hours. It only costs $100,000, but look what it can do. By putting on these mechanical pants, the paralyzed can walk again. There are motion sensors and mechanical braces that assist a person who is paralyzed to get up on their feet and then begin to take a few hesitant steps. But that's not the only game in town. There's another group that's putting out the bionic leg. The bionic leg is not for both legs, it's to allow amputees to walk. But once again, we're talking about motion sensors, we're talking about the ability of paralyzed persons to activate a mechanical exoskeleton that allows them to walk. And again, that's not the only game in town either. There's another group from Berkeley Bionics called E-Legs. E-Legs, once again, are these exoskeletons that you can put on your feet. And wouldn't it be great for people who suffer spinal cord injury or some debilitating muscle disease? We all remember the sad fate of Christopher Reeve. He was the handsome actor who played Superman in the Superman movie series, but he was injured and a spinal cord injury left him a quadriplegic. He was unable to perform hardly any tasks at all. And wouldn't an exoskeleton be of use, whereby he could use his mental ability to control body movements? And speaking about controlling body movements, there are several ways in which these exoskeletons work. One of them is via a joystick. As long as you have ability to move your arms, you can use a joystick in order to control your mechanical legs. Another is, of course, these motion sensors that as soon as you move the leg in one direction, these mechanical legs follow you and magnify the power of your legs. In fact, for the program Sci-Fi Science, which I host for the Science Channel, we actually interviewed an Iraq War veteran who had his arm blown off. However, he was outfitted with a mechanical arm. It gives him the ability to play cards. I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Professor Peter Ward. He's a professor of biology and earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is rather disturbing and is hitting the bookshelves this week. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Now, on exploration, of course, we've had programs about global warming. We've talked about the effect on population and on agriculture and on tropical diseases. But here's a book that talks specifically about how our cities, some of our major cities, will go underwater or may have to be abandoned because of global warming. The book is controversial. However, it gives you a frame of reference as to what scientists are thinking if sea levels continue to rise, not 1 foot, 2 foot, but 5, 6, 7, 8 feet above normal. What happens to our great cities? What about warfare between nations when national borders begin to collapse because of mass migrations of hundreds of millions of people? Something to think about. Once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth.
Much more fun project I've been in, Rare Earth with Don Brownlee. I'd rather do astrobiology.
Oh, but well, I actually interviewed you, either you or Brownlee, I forgot.
Yeah, you did.
And
It just seems to be a happier topic to me to put my head in the sand, but unfortunately, I don't think we can do that much more.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Okay, well, the engineer gave us the go-ahead, so let's start with the first question. Oh, the first question that we always ask our guests is, how did you, as a youth now, get interested in science? So I'll lead off with that question. So, dig back to the cobwebs and think about what it was as a child that set you off in the direction of science. Okay, so the engineer said we're going to start in 10 seconds with that first question about you as a youth. Professor Ward, you're a professor of biology and earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. However, as a youth, what steered you in the direction of science?
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I think scientists know from an early age that they're going to be scientists, so it was indeed youth. What got me going were dinosaurs. My mother and father were from New York. I grew up in Seattle. We didn't have a single dinosaur skeleton, and so I was given this guilt treatment that I had to be in Seattle, and it's my fault or something that there were no dinosaur skeletons, but that got me going.
Okay, and that set you off, and how did you get interested in astronomy and Earth and space science?
Well, I certainly started in paleontology, so I was looking at my feet all the time down at the ground, but it became evident, I think, in the first part of this century, or really the end of the 20th century, that there was a great deal to learn about life in space, and especially how other Earths could be constructed from what we knew in our own Earth history. And so deep Earth history can inform us about astrobiology, and in the book I've just done now, it is deep Earth history which can inform us about what climate change is capable of.
Okay, well, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. So let's start with the ice caps. The North Polar region, over the past 50 years, since submarines have visited the North Pole, seems to have decreased by 50% just in the last 50 years. So what is your projection of the North Pole and also Greenland going into the future?
Well, the great dream of the Europeans coming to North America was for the Northwest Passage. I mean, this was a driving impulse to try to find a quick trade route to China. We're going to have that. But what really I really didn't understand thoroughly enough was the difference between an ice cap and an ice sheet. All of the North Polar ice cap can melt away, and it will have no effect, essentially, on sea level. It is the ice on land, the ice sheets, which are the biggest of which, of course, are Greenland and in Antarctica. Anything that melts on those goes directly into the ocean and raises the level of it. And the biggest, scariest scenario is equivalent to what we call an ice sheet collapse. So imagine you have a cup of really warm water and then dump in about 10 or 15 ice cubes. And up goes the level of that water really fast. Well, that is the scenario for an ice sheet collapse in Antarctica.
Okay, well, we've heard about what's happening in the North Polar region, but in the South Pole, we have huge chunks of ice breaking off. But what does that mean, given the fact that most of the South Pole seems stable, at least temporarily?
You know, I've come back from two separate trips to Antarctica over the last 2 years, and we're looking at deep time events of the climate down there, but you can't help but notice what's going on all around you. It was melting like crazy. When you have both kinds of ice down there. You've got floating ice, which, again, if that melts, doesn't matter. But you've also got all this ice on land. When it melts, the water goes down to the ice rock contact, of course, and that acts as a lubricant. So when you have really anomalous warming, stuff that is on the edge of this can calve off into the ocean. That causes great global change in terms of sea level rise.
Okay, and talking about sea level rise, doesn't the heating of the Earth itself cause expansion of warm water, which causes the sea level to rise? Just the sheer fact that the Earth is warming up.
It sure does. And matter of fact, if we stopped all emissions right now, we just went completely emission neutral, the ocean is still going to rise in its level because of thermal expansion. There's been so much warming already that the ocean has a lag effect, but over the next 40, 50 years, we could expect nearly a 3-foot sea level rise if, based on the temperatures that we have now and the continued warming, just from the thermal expansion, no ice at all.
Okay, 3-foot rise without any ice, and I guess for every 1-foot vertical that you lose, how much horizontal seacoast do you lose?
Well, the seacoast itself is affected more strongly by storm surge. And you can think of storm surge as equivalent to going off a diving board. You jump off a diving board at a given height, but if you bounce a couple of times, you go way higher. It's as if you have a launching platform as sea level rises. The storm surge, which are the nasty big waves that rise higher than normal sea level, can hit coasts. But the sideways movement of the ocean is far more serious in terms of what its salt does. salt goes laterally quite easily, and depending on the type of soil, it is the salinization of the sea level crops that I think is the greatest single danger from sea level rise. It's stunning how much of the world's productivity, and especially the rice regions in Southeast Asia, are on deltas. A delta is built out from a river hitting a calm ocean. If you have a 3-foot sea level rise, every delta on this planet will disappear. We're talking about the Nile, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, and these are all enormously productive areas. So this is the big blow that is coming. The equation is we're going to have a rise in sea level at the same time we have a rise in human population. As you know, we're at 6.6 billion now, but we're heading towards 9 billion. And this, too, is built into the system. It's kind of like the warmth of the ocean. We could do tremendous birth control efforts now, but we're probably still going to hit that 9 billion. So the intersection of 9 billion with reduced agricultural yields because of the sea level rise is the scariest aspect.
Okay, well, let's assume that we do nothing. That is, we simply treat everything as normal. We keep on spewing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Let's take the world 2050. In 2050, what will coastal cities like Boston, New York, Miami, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, what will they look like if we just keep spewing carbon dioxide in the air as if there was nothing wrong? And we project 50 years into the future.
Well, 2050 is still not going to be apparent that we're in a crisis. It's kind of like watching a speed car as it leaves the Indy 500. If you catch it in the first 10 feet or so, it's not going very fast. But acceleration is an interesting thing. It will be apparent to all city planners in 2050 that something new is going on, and they won't like it. Much of city infrastructure is now buried. People put down obviously all the sewage, but now so much of the electrical and advanced communication systems are underground. They were not engineered for salt water. They were engineered for fresh water. Bringing a lot of salt into city infrastructure is going to be a huge headache. It's also going to be a headache for trying to keep freshwater reservoirs going and freshwater aquifers. So 2050 is the time when the alarm bells are going to be ringing. The populace isn't going to see much. It might only be a foot rise by then, but certainly there will be urban red lights going off like crazy.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, we just began an interview with Professor Peter Ward, author of a new book called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And also be sure to catch me on the Science Channel. I host a weekly program on the Science Channel called Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible, based on my New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Impossible. Everything you wanted to know about science fiction, deconstructed and explained through the eyes of a scientist. So once again, it's on the Science Channel, and it's called Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we brought on Dr. Peter Ward of the University of Washington at Seattle, author of an explosive new book hitting the stands right now, even as we speak. The book is called The Flooded Earth, our future in a world without ice caps. So what would it be like in a world where we lose Venice, we lose Miami, we lose Bangladesh, we lose the Mekong Delta? What happens when perhaps nuclear weapons are used to prevent mass migrations, which will inevitably happen as entire nations become flooded, and realize that 50% or so of the world's population lives next to the ocean, many of them in megacities? What happens when some of them go underwater? So once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Think about it, and then ask yourself a question. How far are you from the ocean, and what is your height above sea level? Well, in New York City, a few years ago, we had a gigantic nor'easter which sent a surge of water into Manhattan, which flooded the subway system. And it was not even a very big storm that did that. And some people think that storm surges, even before sea level rise goes to catastrophic levels, storm surges could paralyze the electrical, the plumbing system, and the infrastructure of a city. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, storm surge is definitely the most dangerous short-term effect of this. Look, we saw what storm surge did to New Orleans. It wasn't so much the hurricane itself, Katrina, that battered New Orleans. It was the storm surge. And once again, your storm surge comes from a mean sea level. When you keep raising that mean sea level, storm surge goes up, way up, higher. The most endangered creatures are therefore freshwater plants. And what I really break in my heart is try to think what's going to happen to the Everglades. You've got this enormous freshwater biosystem, which will be so threatened by both storm surge and simply rise in sea level. You cannot live in salt water if you're a freshwater plant. And unfortunately, no saltwater plant, like a mangrove, makes food that humans can eat.
Something to think about. Now let's turn the wheels of time to 2100. What will the great cities of the world look like in 2100?
Well, 2100, there will be 3 feet, only 3 feet if we're lucky, and 5 to 6 feet if we're not lucky. And by lucky, I mean we turn off the lights right now. If it is business as usual, and I suspect it might be because of the increased population numbers, there will be that 3 to 5 foot. The most hard hit will be the wharves. Global transport by ship is still the main means of moving great amounts of food around. CNN projected when I was in Antarctica a few months ago that even a 1 foot rise in sea level will cause shipping terminals and ports and docks and dock heights to have to be modified. And their projection was $1 trillion or more by about 2040 just to spend on the docks. Now, San Francisco Airport, I've landed on that airport over and over and over. A 3 to 5 foot sea level rise in the Bay Area will remove that airport entirely. And so just from the economic points of view, that 3 to 5 foot sea level is going to cause such an enormous financial burden on coast cities.
Okay, the big question, will cities have to be abandoned if sea levels continue to rise 3 to 5 feet, and which cities are we talking about?
Well, we've done a lot of projections on this, and I've been talking to some Dutch engineers. The consensus, and again, this is really just consensus of people looking forward, is that civilization and the cities now could probably absorb a 3 foot, 4 foot, even at the worst case scenario, a 5 foot sea level rise, and survive. But anything above 5 to 6 feet for a lot of cities is not survivable. New York has high ground. It can simply move back. But Miami cannot. Miami is, I think, the poster child of the type of city that will disappear, as Galveston, Texas will, much of the South Florida cities will. And the Netherlands, of course, is in huge trouble. They already have a significant, I think it's 30% of their land area is already under sea level. And they spend an appreciable amount of their GNP on dikes every year, dikes and the equivalent of dikes, sometimes big sandbars. When global economy gets hit hard, it affects everybody, and I think that's what's coming.
Well, what about Boston? Large parts of Boston were reclaimed since the Revolutionary War. If you look at old maps of Boston, large parts of Boston didn't exist until recently. So what's going to happen to Boston?
Yeah, all reclaimed parts of cities are going to go away. The same with my city of Seattle. Our entire bay, Elliott Bay it's called, there's an island. Our major shipping port is an island built up from reclaimed sediment, just as Boston is. And once again, the 3-foot sea level rise allows storm surge, the big storms, to come whipping in and remove a lot of that sediment. You're not going to be able to hold that together. So any city with reclaimed sediment construction, and lots of the airports in Asia, and especially in Japan, they've been building airports out on the water. China's just done it too. All those things will have to be rebuilt somewhere else.
And what about San Francisco, Los Angeles, and especially what's going to happen to New Orleans, where large parts of the city are actually under sea level?
I think New Orleans will have to be abandoned ultimately. It might be a century or two. San Francisco is very interesting. They're very progressive engineers down there. And believe it or not, they have a plan for building a dam right under the Golden Gate Bridge that would save every one of the bay cities. You could hold off sea level rise by building this dam. Otherwise, it's going to be a whole series of smaller dikes and systems and try to save what you can and lose what otherwise. Los Angeles is in an interesting position, too, because the city itself has obviously a lot of high ground, but there are very low-lying areas in Los Angeles that, again, will be inundated to the point that some huge storm comes, salt water is pushed way inland through storm surge, killing off the plants that are there. And then what do you do when you're living in a house that is flooded out by not freshwater, salt water? A saltwater flooding event is way worse than a freshwater flooding event.
And what about London, where we have gigantic underwater devices to help control the water of the Thames River? Are we all going to be like that? Are we all going to be like the little Dutch boy putting our finger in gigantic dikes that we're going to build around our cities? What are we going to do about this?
Well, the British have thought a lot about sea level rise, too, and they are planning on contingencies for up to 5 feet. And you just really hit it. They're thinking about what sort of engineering do we have to do to save our cities? Historic cities, such as London and any of the cities in the Mediterranean, will do everything and anything to try to keep their shorelines as they are now. But it really all depends on where we can stop this. Look, if we melt every single glacier on the planet, we have a sea level rise of over 200 feet. That was the case less than 17,000 years ago. We know from the deep past that when carbon dioxide has been 1,000 parts per million, there is no ice sheet. And we're at 380, 390 and climbing. It's just that to me is the spookiest aspect of it all.
Okay, and what's going to happen to growing areas of the world? Like California has the San Joaquin Valley. Other places have gigantic growing areas. What happens when salt water begins to intrude upon these growing areas?
Agriculture becomes very dicey. Obviously, the San Joaquin Valley is enormously threatened. 20 years ago, it was already recognized that there's salt creeping in. Once again, if sea level goes up a little, salt goes sideways a whole lot. And if any sort of salt within your soil reduces productivity and ends to the point that you can no longer grow crop plants. So this San Joaquin Valley itself is endangered. The northern Sacramento Valley is in trouble. And as I mentioned earlier, every delta on the planet and all that rice from Southeast Asia, those are the targeted places that we should worry about most agriculturally.
Okay, and well, let's be very specific. I live in Manhattan. Manhattan is a little bit above sea level. The place where I am is about, I don't know, 15, 20 feet above sea level. However, certain parts of Manhattan are very close to sea level, Wall Street, for example. So what is Manhattan going to look like, and are we going to have to use a system of dikes to prevent the flooding of Manhattan?
Yeah, there will have to be some sort of mitigation going on in Manhattan, if not for the sea level rise itself, certainly for the storm surge. Again, a small level storm surge is the takeoff point for, or I'm sorry, a small level sea level rise is the takeoff point for storm surge. And in my book, I actually did some elevation counts for various areas and various streets in New York, and not off the top of my head, I actually projected winners and losers in mm-hmm. New York City and its boroughs.
Okay, and let's talk about Venice. Engineers have seriously looked at the problem of Venice. San Marco Plaza, the famous plaza, is actually underwater for parts of the year. So what have we learned by trying to do these gigantic engineering projects like for Venice?
Well, Venice is really interesting because they're putting out into the bay that Venice faces what is sort of a non-traditional dike in a way. It's not like a single wall that the little Dutch boy can put his finger in. But what is interesting and sort of alarming for Venice is also in Holland, it's not just the sea level rise, but it's the fact that the rivers behind yourself, these big cities were often built upon rivers. And because we've got global warming, it's not snowing in many of the mountains, in the Alps and in the Sierra, for instance, snow level is higher. And so instead of snowing in the winter, it rains. And these rivers rise at times they never used to rise before. So Venice is fighting a two-front war, as is many of the Dutch cities. You have to worry about the river that runs through you as much as the sea coming at you. And as any of the military geniuses said, two-front wars are often hard to win.
So Venice may have to be abandoned at some point, you figure?
I would suspect, yes.
Okay, and your book goes beyond 2100, goes to 2300 and beyond. So what is the coastline of the world going to look like now beyond 2100? If I have a map of the world, what will school children see? The North Pole gone? The coastline changing? What will the Earth look like beyond 2100?
Well, it really boils down to some simple geology. Continents, as we know, move around. In the direction that they move, like North America's west coast, there are high mountains generally. But trailing edges, we call them passive edges, don't have mountains, or they have mountains that eroded away, as our east coast does. So you've got the enormous Gulf Plain, you've got the enormous east coast plain in front of the Appalachians. There'll be inroads all through that. The problem that we see is that most estimates and models think up to 2100 and stop. But at 2100, if it's business as usual, say we kept it at 3 feet, it doesn't stop there. It keeps going in accelerated fashion. So if you have 3 to 5 feet by 2100, it's not going to mean that you would have twice that by 2200. You could have three times that high. The acceleration is the most ominous aspect of this business.
So let's just do a computer program. Assume that at some point we stop greenhouse gases into the future, but we just let the computer program run. What will the world look like? Will all the great cities be underwater by then, by 2200, 2300?
No, ice sheets in Antarctica, they are thinning, and they're thinning in both Greenland and Antarctica. A great deal of that water is going in, but the ice sheets are enormously thick in both places. Greenland is far more endangered than Antarctica is. You're not going to see a wholesale flooding of the cities by 2200 or even 2300, which possibly gives us time, but you're certainly going to see effects where the cities that will have to be abandoned, I think that will already be taking place. We just have to maintain these ice sheets with as much integrity as we can, and that means slowing the global warming temperatures, which seem to be inexorable. Look, we just went through this huge recession. We should have had 2 or 3 years because of the economic downturn, when emissions could have been or should have been reduced. They weren't. I mean, they're right up at the IPCC's maximum emission prediction. We're not lowering emissions. We're increasing emissions.
Okay. Now, let's go into the past. You can do that because we can drill into the ice cap and get ice cores from thousands of years ago. 10,000 years ago, we had the Ice Age. It was very cold, 10,000 years and beyond that. So how far back in time do you have to go to find a time similar to what we're going to be experiencing in the future? And what did the world look like at that time?
Well, the conventional answer is that if we get up to 1,000 parts per million, which would happen in 2 centuries from now, if we have some sort of control on emissions, a lot of us think that 1,000 parts per million would be a lot sooner than that. But you're going all the way back to a time called the Eocene, And the Eocene was a very interesting time when we had crocodiles up on the North Pole. We had palm trees in Seattle. We just had this wonderfully tropical climate. The bad news is that sea level was 240 feet higher than it is now because there was no ice. There were no ice sheets at all on the planet.
And when was that?
This was about 50 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But we only have to go back 110,000 years ago to see a world where sea level was at least 10 feet higher than now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's great evidence of this in Florida. In the Florida Keys, there's a beautiful quarry in Windley Key. It's a national park. And you can see big coral heads sitting 4 or 5 feet above sea level. Now, if you go offshore with your mask and flippers, you find the same corals, big Montastria they're called, living down about 10 feet deep. That's the shallowest they can live. So here is evidence, and we can date these with radiometric dating, that 105, 110,000 years ago, sea level was 10 feet higher than it is now, and the entire geography of that place was different. What caused that short-term rise, and this was a blip in the Ice Age, was orbital changes. But at the same time, we had a slight increase in carbon dioxide, and these two conspired to cause a great melt enough to produce a 10-foot rise in sea level.
Uh-huh, 10-foot rise in sea level. So the ice caps, they disappeared 150,000 years ago?
Well, we have very little fossil record of what an ice cap shape looked like because
mm-hmm.
it's floating ice. It doesn't leave any record of itself in sedimentary rock. But we have pretty good evidence on if there's an ice sheet because of the scratches and striations that moving ice produces. You can date some of these surfaces and get an idea about the direction of the ice and even in many cases the thickness of the ice depending on how deep the grooves were.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a pretty good sense of when there was ice and when there wasn't.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about mass migrations and how that could affect world politics. We've had Peter Schwartz of the Global Business Network on our show, and Peter Schwartz is a consultant for the United States Pentagon. And the Pentagon asked the Global Business Network a very simple question. What does global warming mean for the military? What kinds of military conflicts could arise because of global warming? And they looked at the maximum case, and the maximum case shows that you could have mass migrations of not just a million, but tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of people. Look at the situation in Bangladesh, for example. And at that point, national borders could begin to crumble. How do you stop 10 million people from crawling all over your national borders? And what will nations do at that point? At that point, according to the Global Business Network, nations may reach for nuclear weapons to preserve the integrity of their national borders. And they specifically looked at certain hotspots where we have two opposing nuclear powers, and then the question of what happens when borders disintegrate. So what do you think?
Well, the unfortunate thing, I never knew about the Peter Schwartz report, but 2 years ago when I started writing this book, I actually put a 5-page scenario of exactly that, of Bangladesh really collapsing under not just the fact that much of it was being inundated by salt water, but once again, it's that pesky lateral movement. It's not just that they won't have a place to live, it's that the crops fail. I mean, Bangladesh feeds itself now, but barely. But they're projected to have a gigantic population rise. At the same time, they're going to lose this 3-crop rotation per year. And so my scenario certainly sees Bangladeshis pushing into India and India pushing back militarily. Actually, I got this scenario not from the Pentagon, but the CIA several years ago did a very similar sort of assessment. And they, I think, quite presciently said, yes, sea level rise is going to cause migration of borders. One aspect of it that you may not think about right off the bat is sea level rise is going to affect not only coastal cities and coastal agriculture, but much of the transportation corridors on land occur right near or at sea level. Transportation lines, major highways, lots and lots of rail lines, these things will go out very quickly because of storm surge. So when you're talking about mass migration now, if we're the case where sea level is producing mass migration, we're probably in a world where the normal transportation infrastructure has been highly degraded, put it that way.
And what about megacities? If you take a look at population rise, it's not uniform across the world. More and more peasants are leaving the farms, going into these gigantic megacities, creating gigantic mega slums, and of course, they're next to the water. So what happens when they get flooded? Where are they going to go? We're talking about hundreds of millions of people potentially being pushed out of their new home. What's going to happen then?
Well, because most megacities are surrounded in one case or another by at least small to large farmlands. I mean, traditionally it was the case where you had the city, you had the farms surrounding it. Agricultural land will be inundated with humans, and this just exacerbates the problem of feeding ourselves. We're really looking at a case where, look, the elephant in the room is just too many people on this planet. It's just at this stage we have to deal with the idea that the human population can continue to do as it's doing unimpeded. Whatever happened to zero population growth, that movement in the 70s that said slow down, that has disappeared entirely, and that is the single most important part of the equation.
Okay, now that we've painted a picture of what our children, our grandkids, and our great-great-grandkids may face, then the question is, well, what are they going to say when they look back at us? What did we do to prevent this disaster from happening? So do you have any positive thoughts about what could be done, or is it inevitable?
No, actually, there's quite a bit of hope. Look, let's go back 5 years. Global warming was certainly a topic, but I would bet that you would have a hard time finding a single person on the planet now who hasn't heard in one language or another those two words strung together and have a sense of the implications. There has been an enormous amount of work to get the information out. I have to take a shot at journalists, because journalism now is really based on this idea that you have a pro and a con, that every story has to have the negative side. And what makes me laugh is I can imagine somebody now doing an interview about gravity, and here's Isaac Newton, and the anti-gravity side says this. We really have to continue the sense that the word has to get out. And what I find most hopeful is I teach college kids, their generation gets it, their generation is worried, and their generation is doing things about it. And that's my sense of it, that we are going to get a hold of this thing, that we're going to find better and more alternative energy sources. We have to get off the coal habit. They keep saying we're addicted to oil, but the addiction to coal is way worse, way, way worse. And that coal is the cheapest form of energy on our planet, and it is, in a sense, centuries' worth is there. It's not like peak oil. Peak coal is centuries away.
Now, the Chinese are building one coal plant per week. Every week, a new coal plant is created in China. And to be fair, they're also creating solar panels as well. But what's going to replace coal? Even if we reduce our dependency on oil, even though we go electric, electric cars get their electricity from coal. So electric cars, in some sense, make it worse because they get their energy from coal. So what's going to replace coal?
Well, hopefully we have many things. There's not going to be any one single thing. And we're going to have to, again, I hold my nose, embrace nuclear. We're going to have to hope and pray that the experiments taking place in Berkeley, in the labs there for fusion reactors, work. I mean, if we can harness fusion power, boy, we're in great shape. But I think what we're going to have to find are enormous changes in lifestyle. Let's take one. We really need to erase airplane travel the way it is now. Airplanes are horrible polluters. You know, what's wrong with airships, lighter-than-air airships? What's wrong with staying home for vacation? And we scientists, we're among the worst. You know, we flip from place to place, from conference to conference. What about nice old sailing ships? You know, I bring up these ideas and people laugh at me, but can you imagine a beautiful stateroom? You've got your Wi-Fi, and you've got your computer, and you take 5 days to get to your conference. Things have to slow down. Things have to centralize. We need to have old-fashioned medieval cities, centralized, compressed living, circled by farms. The food you produce around you is the food you eat. That is the model for how to survive. What is the next? The big danger is the next 2 centuries. The big danger is the next century, really, with this pulse in human population.
And what reaction have you gotten? A lot of snickers and a lot of eyes rolled to the ceilings when you talk about a lifestyle of the Middle Ages?
Well, they call me Cassandra, and I get this Chicken Little over and over and over. I tried to do an op-ed piece for the New York Times, and they wrote back saying, well, we're not going to print this. And I said, why not? I said, well, it's not that we don't believe you. It's just that it's such a horrible fate that it's just not going to happen. Okay, why not? Well, it's just it can't because it's too terrible. So why scare people? Even if it's going to happen, it's too terrible, so it won't happen.
They actually said that to you?
Yeah, written. I mean, just said, nope, can't do this.
So if it's too terrible,
it makes me laugh.
If it's too terrible, it's not going to happen because it's too terrible.
Exactly. And that's pretty much what I get from most of this conversation.
And last question. If you were to estimate or take a guess as to the most likely scenario, we painted, of course, a worst-case scenario and temperatures keep on rising and so on and so forth. But if you were to then say what is the most likely scenario, what would you say?
I say the population peaks at 9 billion, goes back down to 7 and 6. I say that emissions go up to about 600, and then we bring it back down to the mid-400s.
And why do they go down again? Things don't go down for nothing.
Well, they go down because if we can reduce population, they certainly will go down. And if we can increase the efficiency of power plants, if we can bring in the solar, bring in all these possibilities, yes, they will go down. But I do think we're going to have a case where sea level, in my own estimation, sea level will certainly hit 5 or 6 feet above what it is now, and hopefully doesn't go any higher than that.
Okay, and maybe our properties will be underwater by then.
Well, if you have a view property now, it'll be a waterfront property. And if you have a waterfront property now, you can make it an underwater park.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid that's it for exploration. Once again, you've been listening to our special guest, Professor Peter Ward, Professor of Biology and Earth and Planetary Science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.